This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Brian was just mentioning the visit to the Karaite Center the other day, and so to sort of think of that in the background of this morning's discussion, I think will be useful. We're going to be considering, some of Ezra's activity, at least Ezra's activity according to the rabbinic tradition. It's clear from the book of Ezra that Ezra and Nehemiah are heavily involved not only in the political life of the people, but the religious life of the people. It's clear that Ezra is involved in some sort of creation of ritual. There is a public Torah reading which takes place in the book of Nehemiah. If you haven't seen it, you should have a look. This is in chapter 8 of Nehemiah. And I'm not going to read through the whole thing, but there is this moment, the people gather in Jerusalem in the seventh month, which is the month of Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, etc. And Ezra stands before them. I'm in chapter 8 of the book of Nehemiah, verse number 8. Ezra opens the book, which is to say the book of the Torah, in the eyes of all the people. And he blesses God. All the people say amen and bow down. So it sort of sounds like a Torah reading of sorts. And it's verse number 8 that I'm particularly interested in. So 8:8, the text reports, Vayikru vasefer, they read in the book, B'torat ha'Elohim meforash. They read in the book of the teaching of God that which was explicit, meforash. The verse continues, V'sum sechel v'yavinu b'mikra. V'sum sechel. Okay, so I'm going to write this. Torat Elohim. V'yikru v'sefer. Nehemiah 8:8.
Sorry.
V'sum sechel.
10:20.
Okay. So they read in the book of the teaching of God, Miforash, explicitly, that which was explicit. Vesum Sechel, they placed insight, maybe they applied their minds or something along those lines. Vayavinu Bamikra, and they understood in the text. And so this, I know what this means. This means that they read the Torah, like we read the Torah. But what does it mean to assume seichel? They applied seichel, insight, or knowledge, or wisdom. Vayavinu b'mikra, they understood in the text.
Second part's easy. It's an injunction to become a Karaite.
How so?
B'mikra, that's where Karaite comes from.
Okay.
All right, that's what he
so what do they do? What do the Karaites do with the text?
They don't interpret it.
Just read the Peshat.
No, not necessarily literally, because they understand the concept of metaphors.
Okay.
It's what they don't do. They don't accept rabbinic law.
Okay. So they said
that Hashem gave one Torah and
right.
Not two.
Okay. So again, I don't know, whether this is a Karaite reference or not. It seems to me, actually, that it might be indicating something slightly different. Which is to say, there's something about the text as it is. You can read the text as it is. We do it every Shabbat morning. We simply read the text, right? The question is there more to the exercise or the enterprise of reading text than simply
read
the words? And this verse seems to indicate that there is. I read the text, but that's not all I do. I apply my mind, v'sum sechel, my insight, my wisdom, my understanding, and I understand something that perhaps wasn't obvious when I read it. Okay? So I'm not going to say that this is the source for rabbinic Judaism. I am going to say that when we talk about a text having some sort of integrity, call it, if you will, canonical status, as soon as that text is created, if you want to be able to continue in your life and transmit that to further generations, there's going to have to be some kind of application of that text to new circumstances. And that's what I think is happening here. Okay, so Ezra reads the Torah. But guess what, folks? It's a whole different ballgame when they return from Babylon. The circumstances are so different. The challenges are so different. The issues are so different. How is that text supposed to guide them? And the answer is, apply your mind to it. Search it, understand it, and extract from it something that will serve as guidance for the contemporary issues, not the ancient issues before the exile. Okay? I guess what I'm saying is we all appreciate that circumstances change and things change. And we're not in the same place that we were 10, 20, 30, 100, 1,000 years ago. The question is, how do we deal with those new realities? And this is, I would say, I believe that this is actually the inspiration for Rabbinic Judaism, so to speak. Which is to say, what is Rabbinic Judaism fundamentally about? Applying a text to new realities. Where a text here means a canonical text. Okay? I have some sort of a text which I have sanctified, which I have invested with authority. That text cannot be tampered with, quote unquote. That's what it means to have a canonical text. So as soon as I reduce a text to something which is canonical and cannot be adapted, the question obviously becomes, how will I address new situations? How will I deal with new challenges? There has to be some sort of a mechanism for moving from a canonical text to a new situation that's going to be guided by that text. That's essentially what the process is about. I guess what I'm saying is, Rabbinic Judaism is a very big topic, but fundamentally it's about addressing new contingencies, using a text which is authoritative and canonical. That's what it is. Then we have to figure out how to do that. Are there any rules that have to be followed? Right? Does the mechanism have some sort of a procedure associated with it? Right? How do we determine that what we generated is true and authentic to the original, etc.? But those are details, quote unquote. Right? The fundamental enterprise is moving from one to the other and generating something new as a result. We have to generate something new because we live in a different reality than the original. That's why. Okay? I'm almost tempted to say it's embedded, it's part and parcel of what it means to possess a canonical text. Because it's understood that a canonical text that is written at a moment in time cannot be applied to a different moment unless there's some sort of a mechanism for adapting it. Without changing it, quote unquote. Right? So that's essentially what's happening in this moment. The Torah is being read explicitly, exactly what it says in there. But that's not the end of it. It has to be considered and thought about and understood and applied by Avinu Bamikra, and some new understanding has to emerge.
Is there any evidence in the canonical text by either the people who wrote it or assembled it that they anticipated this?
I mean, I'm almost... First of all, the short answer is yes. In other words, in the Torah itself, there is some sort of a contingency called an authoritative body of interpreters, right, call that the shoftim, if you will, the judges who will interpret, right, and guide. So, but I would say it's sort of like it's a given.
It's obvious.
And any text tradition, by the way, it's not particular to us. Any text tradition that has a canonical text engages in this kind of activity.
That's a raving argument in the United States.
Go ahead.
Well, you've got the strict construction, the Federalists who want to strictly construct the Constitution on the right of the Supreme Court, and the others on their moderate who want to adapt it to the times.
Well,
wow. It's a huge flaming argument in politics today.
Okay.
And the chief proponent of strict constructionism or federalism just died. His name was Scalia. So a new justice was appointed by Trump for the specific purpose of interpreting the Constitution by virtue of its words and not changing it with the times.
Wow.
It's a huge, wild argument, and there is no understanding of what should be done. There's no rule.
Hmm. Okay, so that's an excellent parallel. Yeah?
Just real quickly, would you say that the public reading of this was in and of itself kind of giving permission to open it up so that more people could even understand it to begin the discussion?
I think that would be absolutely implied. Absolutely implied. It wasn't reported, right? It wasn't reported. Okay, so, you know, with this backdrop, really, I want to begin exploring the activity of Ezra in this area. And the rabbis preserve traditions of Ezra as being some sort of a religious reformer, some sort of a inspirational leader, some sort of a teacher. He is a scribe by profession, and obviously that gives him insight into careful reading of the text. The rabbis begin to speak of something called Ezra and his court. Ezra uveit dino. I don't know if you came across this expression in your studies yet. Sometimes they use a synonymous term. Ezra and his court is synonymous to something called the people of the great assembly. Or in Hebrew, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. And according to rabbinic tradition, the men of the great assembly is this governing body. When the people return from Babylon, it's responsible for political and religious leadership, and there isn't a division of church and state back then as we would understand it today. And the rabbis report that there's actually 120 members, which of course becomes the inspiration for the Knesset, right? The men of the great assembly in Hebrew is the Knesset.
And now we have the people of the Knesset.
Yeah. Okay. So, these two things are spoken of in the same breath. They're often used interchangeably. Remember, if you were in my class a couple days ago, and even if you weren't, we spoke about the fact that in terms of the Hebrew Bible, sort of removing beyond that period, the Hebrew Bible, the timeline of the Hebrew Bible basically comes to an end somewhere around this moment. Right? So, in terms of what text we possess, the next major text that we possess in our tradition is the Mishnah. I mean, there's a good 500-year gap over there, 400, 500-year gap, right? We don't have a lot of texts. I mean, there are texts that do exist, by the way. Which texts exist in the gap between the end of the Hebrew Bible and classic rabbinic Judaism? What text exists in between?
The Apocrypha.
The Apocrypha, very good. What is the Apocrypha?
Books or scrolls that weren't included.
Exactly.
Like Judith and...
Good. These are
Maccabees,
Second Temple.
Judith,
these are Second Temple texts. Okay, but they were not made canonical in our tradition. The Catholic Church treats them as canonical. Okay, amazingly.
The Catholic one.
Yes.
Not Protestant.
Correct.
Well.
Okay, the Catholic Church treats these texts as being canonical. They were not preserved, for the most part, in the original Hebrew. They were preserved in Greek. Okay, because the Jews didn't really hold on to them. Yes?
Are you saying then that Ezra compiled the final version of the Tanakh?
I am saying that he would have been involved in some sort of activity associated with that. And the rabbis say as much. Because the rabbis in the Talmud, in Tractate Bava Batra, talk about canonization of the biblical books. And Ezra and his court are part of that activity.
Not necessarily completing it then, or beginning it then, but just part of it.
Correct. And again, sort of it's a much larger discussion, right? There'll be an academic theory, there'll be a more traditional theory, right? But certainly there is an implication in his activity that some sort of process of canonization is taking place, right? So the point is, once I am involved in canonization, then like I said, it's a given that I have to be involved in this other activity. Yes?
One quick thing. Men of the Great Assembly also involved in deciding what's in the canon, or is that another group? Is that happening over a longer period of time?
I mean, I think it would absolutely be implied.
That they are doing it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And the 120 also comes from 12 tribes.
That's a good question. I don't know.
Okay. That's what I was heard about. The Knesset here is based on 12 tribes.
It's a nice idea, actually. It's a nice idea, but I don't know.
Okay.
One thing I did want to say, I think we need to appreciate, if we talk about the Hebrew Bible, that sometimes we think, this is the Hebrew Bible over here, right? That this is the entire literary output of ancient Israel. It's obviously not the case. It's a very small part of the literary output of ancient Israel. What makes it special is this is what was preserved, i.e., the fundamental thrust of canonization is to say, this is a text worthy of preservation. That's what it means on a practical level. On a theological level, it means all sorts of other things. But on a practical level, canonization of text means I am preserving this for posterity because I think it's critical. So this is what's preserved, right? And obviously, in ancient times, it's not like today. I mean, it always amazes me. I don't know if people are amazed by this, but it always amazes me. I can go to the photocopy machine, I can throw this in there, I can create 100 copies in about 2 minutes, and they will all be exactly as accurate as this one. I don't think we appreciate like what that even means. Okay, ancient times, preserving a text was a very, very serious undertaking. And for the most part, as you know, didn't succeed. Right. So the oldest versions of the biblical text that we possess, when are they from? The oldest versions of the biblical text. Those are the oldest. Okay? But those are very, very incomplete in terms of the biblical canon. Yeah, we have the book of Isaiah a couple of times, and you know, fragments from this and fragments from that, right? That's only 2,000 years ago. Right? Only. But if we have a tradition that our text actually extends back another 1,000 years before that, so like, where is it? Where's the text? Right? Before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the oldest text of the Hebrew Bible in our possession dated from the 10th century. Okay? That's shocking. CE. The 10th century CE or the 9th century CE. The good news is when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, more or less, it matched. So we did a good job, obviously, in preserving it. But my point is, The activity of preserving a text, even if it's canonical, is fraught with so many challenges. And I'm not even talking about preserving the accuracy of the text. I'm talking about the physical preservation of the material, right? It's extremely, extremely challenging. So that's my point, right? Yeah.
How old is the Aleppo Codex?
That's 10th century. Yeah, that's it. So we have like bits and pieces from, I think, the 7th century. Various other texts, but the only complete quote unquote Hebrew Bible, the earliest one, is the 10th century. Okay, so that's shocking. That's shocking. Yes.
Yeah, I don't know 100% the story, but my son is involved in all this. But with the Quran, also people just get pages. you know, you were in Saudi Arabia in a little village, you had 2 pages. You were in a village, you know, 5,000 kilometers away, you had the next 3 surahs. You know, they didn't have everything.
Hmm. That's interesting. Okay, so again, I think it's sort of a challenge.
They were much more spread.
Yeah.
Middle East.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, any text tradition faces this challenge in ancient times. And again, my point is that canonical text tends to be a rather small sample of whatever's floating around out there. Okay? But that's what's preserved ultimately. For
there are references even in Torah to books that we don't have.
Correct. Even Ezra collects like 10 different references maybe in the Hebrew Bible to books that are no longer extant. Okay, that's in biblical times. There's already a recognition that certain things no longer exist. Right? We read about it one in last week's parsha, Sefer Milchamot Hashem, right? The book of the wars of the Lord.
That's a good one.
Right?
I hope somebody finds
it. What are some examples that the Catholic Church uses that we don't? Like, what books are there?
Oh, in the Apocrypha?
Maybe you've heard of the book of Judith.
We talk about her around Hanukkah time. Right, I don't know, there's this custom to have dairy foods on Hanukkah, if you're familiar with that, because these are the foods that Judith fed the enemy general before she cut off his head. Now, there is an echo of that story that's preserved in the Midrash, but it's actually an apocryphal work. Okay, that's preserved in the Apocrypha. And there's all sorts of stuff, very interesting stuff. Tobit, Enosh, there's a whole bunch of stuff. Some of it is a little bit, shall we say, controversial in terms of the content or in terms of the theology, and maybe that's why it wasn't preserved. I mean, there's all sorts of discussions as to why these works did not ultimately find some sort of a place in the Jewish canon. Don't forget, you know, we talked about it last time a little bit, officially at least, and this is the rabbinic reading, the age of prophecy, quote-unquote, comes to an end with the return from Babylon. This stuff is post. So it could very well be that, you know, once we made the cutoff, and maybe they're part of that, once we make that cutoff, you just can't put new stuff in the Hebrew Bible. It's too late. But it could be that simple, yes?
And the victors make the choices. I mean, if Oscar were in charge today, we wouldn't have Sheha Shalim as part of our canon.
That's a good point.
Who's in charge?
Because they've got difficulty.
Correct. Okay, so clearly, you know, whoever is in charge makes the determination, that's true. Okay, all right, so I want to begin, we're going to look at a case study of sort of this activity in action. And I want to begin with just a very, very brief reference in source number 2 in your sources for this morning. And I'll give you the sort of the context of the discussion here. You know that we say Havdalah at the conclusion of Shabbat, right? Most of us are familiar with that, Havdalah, at the conclusion of Shabbat. You've got your candle, and you've got your wine, and you've got your spices, and you say these series of blessings that basically usher the Shabbat out. What many people may not be familiar with, especially those that don't regularly attend Saturday night Ma'ariv, is that there's actually a Havdalah, which is part of the prayer service, part of the Shmoneh Esrei. And in Talmudic times, or Mishnaic times actually, there was a debate. When do we actually insert that Havdalah in the prayer service? That's the discussion that you have in source number 2. And Rabbi Akiva says, we have a separate blessing in the Shmoneh Esrei, blessing number 4, which is devoted to Havdalah. Okay, it's its own separate blessing. And there are those that disagree. So I just want to read the first line or two of the source. I'm in source number 2. Amar le Rav Shemen bar Abba le Rabbi Yochanan. Rav Shemen bar Abba turned to Rabbi Yochanan and he says the following. Michti. Let's have a look at this. Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the great assembly, I mentioned them, that's Ezra in disguise. Tiknu lahem le Yisrael, they instituted for the people of Israel the following things. Brachot u'tfilot kiddushot v'havdalot. Blessings and prayers, sanctifications and havdalot. Nechze heichan takun. Why don't we consider where they inserted it in the prayer service? I don't want to get into the details here. I just want to focus on the statement that Rav Shemin is saying to Rav Yochanan, the men of the Great Assembly are responsible for four areas of activity when we talk about liturgy. Four liturgical areas. What are they?
The words.
One second. Brachot, tefillot, kiddushot, havdalot. Brachot means blessing. Tefillot means prayers. Kiddushot means sanctifications. Havdalot means distinctions. Havdalah. Okay? These are all liturgical texts. Okay? So what does this indicate? Clearly Ezra and his court, the men of the Great Assembly, are up to something. They are creating something. They're innovating something. They're mitaken something. Instituting something. And whatever it is, it can be divided roughly into four major categories. And these are they. There's a category called the category of blessings. There's a category called the category of prayers. Sanctifications. Let's sort of talk about each one of these in turn for a moment. What is blessings? Blessings, liturgically. Anyone think of some blessings that are part of the liturgy?
Bless you on the Lord
our God. On what? Yeah?
On what?
Yeah, on what?
On Rekriya 8.
Okay, food. Food.
Seeing a rainbow.
Okay, certain sights, right? Or enjoyments. What else? Blessings on the Shema, okay? Blessings that are part of the prayer service, in other words?
On the holidays in
Lordan. Blessings on the holidays, okay? Blessings on the performance of a mitzvah, Sher Kipshanu B'mitzvotav, right? You light Shabbat candles, Sher Kipshanu B'mitzvotav L'Hadlik Ner Shal Shabbat, etc., right? So blessings is kind of like this big ritual world, right? That's one category. Tfilot, prayers. What are some of our non-biblical prayers? Shmoneh Esrei is the classic one. Okay, any others that you know of? Think of the prayer service. Is there anything in there that's non-biblical, but it's part of the prayer service? Aleinu, possibly.
Kaddish.
Kaddish, that might come under this. Probably comes under this category. Okay, maybe. In other words, we have a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, obviously part of the challenge will be to determine what in the Siddur is early, what in the Siddur is late. Okay? But just to offer the possibility, we have stuff in the prayer service which is being ascribed to these people. Okay? Kiddushot. You said Kaddish. Any other things that sound like kiddushot? Kiddush, perhaps, which is also a blessing part, right? Kiddusha, which is part of the Shmoneh Esrei, right? So all that stuff pertains to liturgy, right? And Havdalot. Well, that was our subject, right? The Havdalot that we recite on Motzei Shabbat. There are other Havdalot that we recite. When Yom Tov ends, there's a Havdalot. Right? When Yom Tov begins after Shabbat, there's a different Havdalah, etc., right? So my point is that the Gemara here is assuming that Ezra Uveitino, the men of the Great Assembly, are responsible for being quote-unquote mitaken, right? Where mitaken, you could translate that as instituting, or maybe setting down. Literally, it might mean fixing, installing, right? But fixing might not mean it's broken. It just might mean that you're making it fixed, right? You're making it set, in other words. Setting down.
The word is affixed.
Affixed, do you have in the English? Okay. Okay, so it's some sort of, I guess, transformation such that whatever may have been informal now becomes formal. Okay?
Well,
that's what liturgy is, by the way. Liturgy is formal. You've got a text, and you can sort of appreciate, just sort of think about it through the lens, the prism of canonical text. Right? If that's how I think about the world, right, that's my lens through which I see the world, canonical text, or creating canonical text, then you can readily appreciate how this activity is similar. Right? Liturgy is creating some sort of a formal text. And when the Rambam describes it, he says, guess what, folks? You cannot depart from the liturgical form. Anyone who violates the liturgical form and adapts it, Rambam says, eino ela toe, is simply mistaken and must go back and say it again. But you can sort of understand that liturgy sort of takes its inspiration from canon. It's exactly the same kind of thing which is happening, except that one, quote unquote, is received, whatever that means, and the other is clearly being created by human beings at a particular moment in time.
Can you give us years when this that's occurring?
Okay, good question. When is Ezra active? Roughly. Something like that. Let's just say the 5th century BCE. Okay. Remember that the temple was destroyed, the first temple, in the 6th century BCE. And they were in Babylon for a good few decades, right? And then people started to return under the Persian kings, right? So it's that return that serves as the engine for this activity. And that's happening in the 5th century. The events of Purim are happening around the same time. Right,
I was just thinking about the connection between Mitkan and the Taken HaOlam.
Good.
I thought that was
it,
to
repair. You know, the Taken Olam, maybe it means to set the world, or to create some sort of a framework for the world, right? In a way that it doesn't yet possess. But that's the root, you're right, this is the root.
Takana. Is this doing it for the people in Babylon? Or the people who are returning, or there's...
It's a really good question. I mean, he's not active in Babylon. He's active in the land of Israel.
Oh, he's in Israel.
Is this somehow finding its way back to those communities? The short answer is yes. Right? At what point? I don't know exactly. But clearly the people in Babylon are aware of this activity. Right? This, by the way, you think American Jewry and Israeli Jewry... And the whole kerfuffle, I mean, it's an ancient thing, by the way. Right? The community in Babylon and the community in Israel often disagreed over who had authority. Right? Who has authority over the people of Israel, quote-unquote? Who makes these determinations? Right? Yeah?
Is the Second Temple functioning?
Yes, it is.
Which is remarkable, no?
Why?
Because, hello, we've got sacrifices. What are we doing with this stuff?
Good. Okay, so Second Temple is functioning. But as you know from Ezra and Nehemiah, the challenges of the age are serious. Okay? Even though there is a temple, there are many other things which are happening which are, you might say, inimical to a temple standing in the people's midst. But yes, it is remarkable. Now, you're already assuming with that statement, Brian, that somehow sacrifices and liturgy don't quite match up.
Maybe what I'm suggesting is that when the first temple was functioning, and I'm speaking from ignorance, so I stand to be corrected,
okay,
but they didn't feel the need for liturgy when they had the structure of the twice daily sacrifices.
All right, so that's...
Maybe apart from the Tehillim, maybe.
That's really an excellent question, an excellent point, and an excellent segue for what we're going to be doing now. Okay? So we're going to look at source number one. Source number one. I'm going to ask us to spend a few minutes studying it in Chavruta. with our partner, whoever happens to be next to us. So this is sort of, you know, I would say at first glance, this appears to be some sort of a disagreement about what I'm going to call the origins of prayer. Okay, so that's our subject for now, the origins of prayer. And we're going to see that there's a disagreement. And we're going to look for two opinions. So I want us to try and isolate two opinions. Right? That's the first thing. And then to ask ourselves, what proofs, quote unquote, does each opinion marshal to support its view? Okay, so first of all, what is the opinion? Second of all, what's the proof for the opinion? And third of all, is there some sort of a resolution at the end? I.e., did the two opinions ultimately come to some sort of a compromise, some sort of an agreement? Okay, so let's spend a few minutes looking at source number one. It's a Talmudic discussion in Tractate Brachot. Do not get bogged down in the details, okay? You'll sort of reach these points in the discussion where you say, yeah, wait, what does that have to do with it? Or I didn't quite understand what that was talking about. Don't worry about that. Okay, we're sort of looking for the bird's eye view of this discussion. Don't get bogged down in the sort of digressions, okay, that you're going to come across as you make your way through. So let's spend a few minutes doing that, source number one, and then we will reconvene. Let's reconvene, people. Are we ready? Right. Origins of prayer is ostensibly what this disagreement is about. We have two opinions, Rabbi Yosei, Rabbi Hanina, and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Okay. Now, I'm not going to sort of get into this too much, but just bear in mind, these personalities are alive rather late in the day. Okay, they're the first generation of the Amoraim, or so, which means that I've already passed the period of the Mishnah, and I'm entering the period of the Gemara, and that's when we're asking ourselves the question for the first time, seemingly, oh, well, where did these prayers come from anyways? Okay, what does he say?
And dates, when they're doing this?
When they are active, let's say around the 4th century CE, 4th century or so. Okay, that's, yeah, not so long ago in our tradition. All right, Rabbi Yosei, Rabbi Hanina, well, what does he say? The origins of prayer?
Patriarchs.
Very simple, right? We have three prayers. We have three patriarchs. Abraham institutes the morning prayer, Yitzchak, afternoon prayer, Yaakov, evening prayer. Okay? Morning, afternoon, evening. Of course, he's going to struggle a little later with the Musaf prayer, because I've only got three patriarchs, but I have four prayers.
Could have done the mothers.
Right, that would have made it easier. We would have solved it easily by going with the matriarchs instead of the patriarchs, but he didn't make that move. So he's left, in the end, acknowledging that he's going to need something else to explain the Musaf prayer. Right? Rabbi Yosheva ben Levi, on the other hand, says clearly the prayers are sacrifices. Okay, which sacrifices are we talking about? The daily sacrifice. We'll talk about what that means shortly. All we have to know for now is there are two daily sacrifices. There's a morning one and an afternoon one. Right. His challenge is going to be to explain the evening prayer, because after all, there is no evening sacrifice. Right? There is no evening sacrifice. So how does he explain the evening prayer? The remnants of the afternoon sacrifice, which continue to burn on the altar all night long. So sort of each one has their own Waterloo, you might say, in this discussion. In the end, is there a resolution, is there not? Do we sort of agree at the end of the day? There is a resolution. We all acknowledge, right? Oh, the patriarchs instituted prayer, and the rabbis came, whoever those mysterious rabbis are, right? And they found support for prayer in the sacrifices.
Were sacrifices and prayer going on simultaneously?
That's an excellent question.
Because I always thought that prayer started sort of almost miraculously after the destruction of the Second Temple.
Excellent
but
question.
In fact, was it based on a much earlier time?
So you tell me.
I would have thought on the earlier time.
Okay, and I think you're absolutely right.
That's what this is doing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Okay, this is essentially saying there's an idea of prayer which clearly predates sacrifice. Although the patriarchs also engaged in sacrifice, to be honest, right? But the Talmud here is understanding that they're engaged in the activity of prayer. So I want to look at this a little more closely and begin to explore this as more than a discussion about origins, which is ostensibly what it is. So let's look at it more closely and appreciate what we're actually saying. How do I know that Abraham instituted the morning prayer? I have a proof text, right? What's my proof text? The text reports, Vayashkem Abraham Baboker, Abraham got up early in the morning. By the way, he's the only early riser among the patriarchs. That phrase is reported by him. Okay? Vayashkem Abraham Baboker. What did he get up for?
The Akedah,
right? You sure?
That's it. I mean, it's yes.
So actually, it does report by the Akedah that Abraham arose early in the morning.
This one is when he prays about stone.
Ah, okay. There's actually two references to Abraham getting up early in the morning, which is what I meant by he's an early riser. Okay. The one that the Gemara is actually quoting is in Genesis 18. And the context is...
He prays for the people of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Okay.
He argues with God, too.
Excellent. Okay.
19.
The fate of Sodom... it's 18, I think.
Well, 19. The text says 19.
Sorry, you're right, it is 19. Okay, he's praying for the fate of Sodom. Well, actually, it's already past that prayer. Remember, he did the whole negotiation. If there's 50 righteous people, you won't destroy it. Right, God? Right. 45, 40, 30, 20, 10.
And then he gives up.
Then he gives up. By the way, I mean, I don't want to make too much of this, but if you think the rabbis invented a minyan, it's actually right there. Which is to say there was an understanding in Abraham's negotiations that don't bother going under 10 because 10 is critical mass. You don't have community without 10. Right? So that's going to be the inspiration later on for creating something formal and liturgical called a minyan. But the inspiration's already in the text. Again, that's like I've been saying this the whole time. You start with a canonical text, and what does that mean? You look in there for guidance. You're going to extract something from there to help you meet the new contingencies. That's what it means. And so you will comb it with a fine-tooth comb in order to find that inspiration. All right? In any case, Abraham negotiates in chapter 18. God says, fine, if there's 10 men there that are righteous, I will not destroy Sodom. The next morning, Abraham wakes up. That's what our verse is from. Abraham woke up the next morning to the place where he had stood, and standing means nothing but prayer, as the verse says in Tehillim, Pinchas stood and he prayed. And what does Abraham discover? Now I'm going to ask us to think about the context of the prayer. What does Abraham discover? It has been destroyed. Let's put an X through it. Okay? What the text describes at that moment is, Vihine Allah Kitor Ha'aretz. The smoke rises like the smoke of a furnace. Sodom has been incinerated. And Rabbi Yosef says, guess what, everybody? That's inspiration for Shacharit. Right? So I want us to put ourselves in Abraham's place for a moment and ask ourselves, let's just say that this is the inspiration for Shacharit. What is the emotional content of the moment? For Abraham Avinu. What is he feeling?
Mournful.
What else?
That they weren't answered. His prayers weren't
good. Rejected.
And therefore, wouldn't any normal mortal feel waking up and seeing his prayers were no good? Why should I bother?
Excellent.
Frustrated.
Digested. Anything else? What else?
I'm not sure. I'm just not sure I agree with this. I think a little Talmudic here. the deal was 10. Obviously, they weren't 10. He would have known that.
Yes.
I think he would have felt insignificant to witness the power of God.
Excellent.
Insignificant.
But God's overwhelming power. Insignificant. Okay? Etc. By the way, there's one other thing that might be on his mind.
Lot worried.
Which is the fate of Lot.
Yeah.
Did Lot survive that, or did he not?
Yeah.
Okay? So I'm not suggesting that this should be the inspiration for all of our morning prayers. I'm just saying, you know, this is probably a pretty good sketch of what Abraham may have felt at that moment when Shacharit is born. Okay? Great. Yitzhak institutes the afternoon prayer. How do I know? Because I have a text. What does the text say? Yitzhak went out into the field to meditate in the field at evening time. Right? And meditation means nothing but prayer because we have a proof text from Tehillim. The text says, Tfilah la'ani ki ya'atof lifnei Hashem yishpoch sicho. The afflicted, the poor, pours out their prayer before God, their meditation. Right? Context. What's the context of that moment? Rivka's coming. Okay, so, now I don't know if he knows that Rivka is coming. He just sees the camels on the horizon.
Anticipation.
So again, if we play sort of the game of figuring out, you know, what he's experiencing emotionally, anticipation, anything else?
Fear and worry. When it
worked out. It's going to, you know, it's the first shidduch date in Jewish history. Who knows what's going to be? Like, is this the woman for me or is she not? Is there a woman or is there not? Right? Anything else? It's a very different kind of, you might say, tone than Avraham's prayer. Right? There's something hopeful about this, optimistic about this, and like in this original prayer of Abraham, probably looming in the background is some other remembrance or thought. Well, someone close to Yitzchak that's on his mind as he marries his new wife.
His mother.
But we know that because when Rivka arrives, he brings her into the tent of his mother, Sarah. She becomes his wife, and he loves her. And he was comforted after the death of his mother. That's reported explicitly in the text. I don't want to get into the whole Freudian thing. That's a whole other thing. All I'm saying is, just like Lot looms in the background of Abraham's concerns, Sarah looms in the background of Yitzhak's prayer. All right, Yaakov. What's the context of Yaakov's prayer? Of all the ones in the list, this is the least explicit. And the most explicit at the same time. Right? What does the text say? Yaakov came to the place. He encountered the place. And we understand encounter here means nothing but prayer. We have a proof text from Jeremiah to that effect. What is the context of Yaakov's prayer? This is the latter scene, right before the latter scene. So give me sort of the general context of the moment.
He's escaping from his brother.
He's
escaping from Esav's wrath. Escape. Okay, you may remember the scene. Yaakov steals the blessing. Eventually, his father and his mother will send him off to find a wife in Haran. But Esav is very, very upset. In fact, it's Rivka who says, you've got to get out of here because he's planning to kill you. And he flees under cover of darkness, right? All alone. And he gets to that place, and according to Rabbi Yosef or Rabbi Hanina, he institutes the nighttime prayer. What's he feeling?
Fear.
How do you know? Here we don't have to guess. We don't have to guess. Why don't we have to guess?
It says.
Because God appears to him in a dream. And what does God say?
Don't fear.
I'll take care of you. I won't abandon you. You will become the progenitor of that nation. I will restore you to this land. I will guard over you in your travels. It's not a stretch to suggest that everything that God says in that dream moment is a response to the fears that Yaakov is experiencing. A reassurance of what it is that he's feeling at that time. Okay? Reasonable. So we know what he's feeling. Okay. So we have three patriarchs. Three prayers. Right? Three moments. I'm going to ask us to see if we can create some sort of a common denominator or denominators, right? What does a patriarchal prayer look like or feel like? How would you describe it?
So it's outside.
Outside. Excellent. It's always outside.
Based on personal experience.
It's very, very personal. Right? The only person who understands what Avraham feels at that moment is Avraham. Etc. By the way, it's not an accident that all three of these prayers are recited in splendid isolation. There is no family. There is no community. It's only the individual standing before God. Okay, so there's an isolation here.
It's a position of powerlessness.
Say again?
A position of powerlessness.
Good. I'm going to call it vulnerability. Right? They all are vulnerable for various reasons.
These emotions are not like positive emotions. They're all dealing with like the
stress.
Yeah, stressful kind of
stressful
emotions.
Okay, so I'm going to call it charged emotional moments. I mean, yeah, Yitzchak could be more positive, but let's just call it, you know, in generic terms, it's a charged moment. Okay, it's a personal moment, it's a charged moment, it's an individual moment, it's a sincere moment. Okay? There's no artifice in these prayers whatsoever. Are you cold?
Supplication.
Cold?
To God?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's freezing.
Freezing. I don't have a control, but at least I can open the door.
I don't think it was freezing, it was the Middle East. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were still.
It was up there, but it's gone now.
It's gone. Hold on one sec.
Thank you. Mindy wants to know when she can come. You've got the jacket. It's gone. So what time is lunch?
1:30.
You're going to the summit?
Yeah.
So that's all she has to do.
I'll turn it down.
Yeah.
So if it works.
What was it on, Michael?
Well, I can't tell you because these remotes work for all the air conditioners, so whatever's on here is the last air conditioner that it can pull. But I turned down the fan in any case. Okay. Should I make it warmer?
No.
Okay. All right. So this is what we have. Okay, this is what we have. Yes.
Supplication to God, does that come under vulnerability?
Supplication? Yes. Absolutely. Okay, this is a heartfelt supplication to God. Okay? Do we agree on the list, more or less? This is what characterizes these prayers?
Yeah.
Here's my million-dollar question. Rabbi Yosei bar Rabbi Chanina said, the patriarchs instituted prayer. So my question to you is, what would it take to turn this into an institution? Or, to put it differently, if you had to write the liturgy that would somehow capture the patriarchal prayer, what would it look like?
Nothing like this.
Why?
Because this is very moment, it's based on a crisis at the moment.
Excellent.
The liturgy is kind of a routine.
Excellent. This is about spontaneity, and it's actually the antithesis of liturgy. Which is to say, if I were to take this and convert it into a liturgy, it would die. The essence of this prayer is something which is reactive. I'm in the moment and I have to react. And that reaction comes from deep inside. And I compose the words as it unfolds. And if I were to somehow compress this into a formula, which is what liturgy is, it would lose everything precious and everything meaningful. Really, what I'm saying is, Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina might be telling us, if you want to know what prayer is really about, this is what it's about. And I'm almost sure, if we went around the room and asked each person, what do you think about this model? You'd say, it sounds fantastic. Wow, I go to shul and it's nothing like that. It's like, this is exciting. This is meaningful. This speaks to my actual life and not somebody else's life. Yeah. This sounds great. I could really identify with this kind of prayer. Okay? Yeah.
So, formalized liturgy, I think what you're saying, it isn't like that.
Yes.
But I think in modern times, you know, they always say, like, there are no atheists in a foxhole. Humanity, I would venture to say, does the spontaneous prayer that you might say when you're in a moment of crisis.
Yes.
Or, you know, does have these elements to it.
Yes, absolutely.
We do this.
We do.
Humankind does
this. So really
this.
What you're saying, and I want to sort of explore that a little bit more. First of all, what you're saying is, this is universal. This is not particular to us. And I think you're absolutely right. This is universal. And you're also saying, frankly, right, from the moment when human beings possess some sort of a consciousness or a self-awareness of who they are, what they are, that's when this kind of a prayer would have been born. So coming back to your earlier question, right, I always thought you said that when the sacrifice is ceased, that's when prayer is invented. This is saying that's not the case. Prayer was invented at the beginning of time. Because it's a human need. In a moment of crisis, this is how we have to respond. Now, there might be exceptions, I know. But most of us probably, in moments of crisis, will somehow engage in one way or in another with something resembling this kind of an activity. Okay? So clearly, whatever this is about, it has nothing to do with sacrifices, actually. Nothing whatsoever. It exists completely independently of any other model for prayer that may have come into the world at some other time. Okay? Yeah?
If it isn't coming out of that, prayer is what we need to address and deal with these emotions.
Okay.
It's not the emotions bring me to the need to have prayer. How do I... So the liturgy is like a fixed liturgy and almost responds to these emotions.
I mean, I could appreciate how you could turn it into a liturgy. All I'm saying is, it's a dangerous move. Because you're going to compromise something about the spontaneity or the essential quality of what this is about. By the way, we do have an expression of this kind of material in our tradition, even in a semi-liturgical form. I think the Talmud sort of alluded to it with the proof texts, right? What did Bubi, Grace Abubi, and Grace Azadi do when they were in an existential crisis? Where did they turn? What did they turn to in terms of our text tradition?
Tehillim.
What does Tehillim sound like if you've ever read parts of it?
It's personal.
It's individual. It's emotional. It's charged. You could sort of hear that it might be spontaneous, and we'll find expression for our need to pray to God in that text. Okay? So I guess what I'm saying is, in our tradition, we do possess expressions of this kind of activity. But to institutionalize it would snuff it out. Without a doubt, yes.
But isn't what Yosef Baruch Hanina is saying is, it's not so much the content, but just the timetable that they instituted this schedule.
Maybe. But again, all I'm saying is, it's hard to assign a schedule to this. Right?
Oh, I know, but there was evidence that there was evidence that filah took place morning, afternoon, evening.
Yes.
That's the precedent for what the rabbis wanted to do.
Yes.
It's already happening at this point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. All I'm saying is all the attempts to turn this into an institution are fraught with danger. Okay, but nevertheless, I mean, you're right, we do institutionalize it. That's the point. My question is, and maybe his point is, we're turning this into an institution, but what ultimately are we trying to preserve? What should prayer feel like? What should prayer sound like? And the answer is like this. Okay? I want to go on to the second view. Does anyone need a break? Should we take a break for a few minutes?
Yeah.
A couple minutes? Okay, so literally 2 or 3 minutes, and then we're going to come back and continue the discussion because we still have a lot to do. And ultimately, see how Ezra is involved in this activity, which is a point.
Yeah.
We're almost all here. I'm going to get started, though. I want to consider the second view, daily sacrifice view. And I think what will emerge from considering the second view is that this actually turns out to be a glaring study in contrasts. Okay. Sacrifices. Well, we all know about sacrifices, right? I don't want to get into the whole discussion of, you know, for or against right now. That's a separate discussion. Just let's sort of like take it, as it were, as a given. Okay. When we talk about sacrifices, so we can talk about all sorts of things. We can talk about communal sacrifices. We can talk about individual sacrifices. We can talk about obligatory sacrifices. We can talk about voluntary sacrifices. There's like, you know, a flavor for everybody in the world of sacrifices. But this does not say sacrifices. It says daily sacrifices. Okay? And the daily sacrifice is a very particular category. And I want to explore what it is. Okay? In Hebrew, it's called the tamid. The tamid sacrifice. The tamid sacrifice consisted of a one-year-old lamb in the morning, one-year-old male lamb, one in the morning, and one in the afternoon, twice a day. Okay? That's called the daily sacrifice. Why is it called the daily sacrifice? Because it's every day. Is it on Shabbat?
Yes.
It is. Is it on Yom Tov?
Yes.
It is. Is it on the 4th of July? It is. Every single day, without fail, is the daily sacrifice. It's the only sacrifice that has that quality.
How can you do a sacrifice on Shabbat?
That's the way it is.
How can you make fire on Shabbat?
It's a great question. Let's just say that's the way it is. Okay? A daily sacrifice means a daily sacrifice. It's not that the rabbis weren't troubled by that. They were. But at the end of the day, that was the conclusion. It really highlights just how tamid this sacrifice is. There isn't a day that goes by that the sacrifice is not offered, as long as the temple stands in Jerusalem. In fact, I'd go so far as to say, if I were living in Jerusalem, I could set my watch to the daily sacrifice. I'd get up in the morning, and I could set my watch to the morning sacrifice. I'd come home from work in the evening, I could set my watch to the daily sacrifice. That's what it was like, clockwork. Okay? There's a tractate of the Mishnah which records the entire ritual of the sacrifice. Guess what it's called? Tractate Tamid. Okay, so you can read all about it. It's a little gory now and then. But it just, I mean, the point of having a sacrifice offered every single day is you can actually record that. You can describe that in some detail. That's what Tractate Tamid is about. Okay, so that's our first, I would say, fundamental understanding of the nature of this thing, is that it is absolutely constant and predictable. Okay, you just know when you get up in the morning what they're going to be doing in the temple first thing. You just know when you come home in the evening, what they're going to be doing in the temple last thing.
It introduces the temple day and it concludes it. Okay, who's the sacrifice brought for? On whose behalf is it brought?
Community.
The community, the people of Israel. Okay, it is a communal sacrifice. That is its essential quality. Okay? It's not like, you know, I have to bring a sin offering because I did this or that or the other. Or I have to bring a peace offering because I'm feeling really good about, you know, my new promotion at work or whatever it is. This is a communal sacrifice. It's brought on behalf of the people of Israel. Now, strictly speaking, rabbinic tradition says, when I bring a sacrifice, I have to be there. Strictly speaking, the people of Israel should be there twice a day. Well, they can't all be there twice a day. So we got something called the House of Representatives, rabbinic version, right? That there were actually people chosen from the people of Israel to represent the community. And they would gather in their cities as this sacrifice was offered and engage in all sorts of ritual activities, readings and studies and things of that sort. It's called the Ma'amadot, Ma'amad. Those that stand, as it were, over the sacrifice as it's being offered on behalf of the people of Israel.
You just said in their city, so
yes.
Not in Yerushalayim.
Those that were close to Yerushalayim would come to Yerushalayim, and those that weren't would gather in their hometowns, whatever it was, in the synagogue. Okay, this is described in the Mishnah in Ta'anit and in the Mishnah in Tamid. Okay, who pays for this?
Okay, so you had sacrifices being burnt all over the country?
No. Only at the temple. I'm saying the gatherings would take place all over the country at the time that the sacrifice was offered.
I see.
Who pays for this thing?
Community.
The community. What does that mean? Like, where does that money come from? There's a tax. There's a temple tax. It's called the half shekel. The half shekel tax pays for communal sacrifices. Right? There's a whole beautiful Dvar Torah about the half shekel, right? Why isn't it a whole shekel tax? Because the whole point is to demonstrate and to illustrate you're not whole unless you're joining with someone else in the community. You're just a half. That's the most you can be. Oh, when we join together, we create something bigger. That's called the half shekel tax. Okay? So here's a sacrifice that's paid for with communal funds. It's offered on behalf of the community of Israel. There isn't a day that goes by when it's not presented on the altar. Right? So like Sadie and Irving Goldstein can decide, we're going to sponsor the daily sacrifice today in commemoration of our 50th wedding anniversary. That's not how it works. Okay? There's no such thing as personal sponsorship. It comes from communal funds. Okay? Not only that, as Mary would say, the priest gets up, the Kohen gets up, he doesn't say, hey, you know what, guys? Let's mix it up a little bit today. We always bring the same boring one-year-old male lamb. Why don't we throw in a calf? Just for fun. Right? Or do it a little differently. That's not how it works. Okay? If you want to appreciate what routine is about, okay, what habit is about, what something ongoing is about, right? If that's your personality, you're going to love the daily sacrifice. Because that's what it's like. There's nothing spontaneous. There's nothing individual. There's nothing unexpected. There's nothing novel. It's absolutely routine every single day. Now, when I phrase it that way, you can readily appreciate that it stands in glaring contrast to everything that this is about. Or, to put it differently, what actually emerges from analyzing this disagreement is it has something to do. It has little to do with really the question of the origins of prayer. It has to do with understanding what is the essence of prayer. What are we trying to achieve at the end of the day? Now, to be perfectly honest, we can look at this list and say, you know what? I really like this list. It's clear to me what the advantages of this list are. It's sincere. It's heartfelt. It's spontaneous. It's spiritual. All that stuff that we just love and would love to have in our synagogue service, right?
it's clear what the advantages are.
And it's relevant.
It's relevant. It's immediate.
It's messy.
It's messy. That's what life is like and the rest of it, right? Are there any disadvantages to this model?
All of those things, yeah.
Why?
It's chaos.
It's chaotic. Okay, let me ask you a question, for all of us a question. If we understand that prayer is something about, maybe primarily about, the encounter with God, or, put it differently, forging a relationship, the question is, will this be a successful model for forging a relationship?
No. It's capricious.
Absolutely capricious, i.e. there might be people out there that will never experience a moment like this, or very rarely.
Come back another week.
Correct, right? If you want consistency, if you want ongoing encounter, this is not the way to go. Oh, what about this one for a second?
This is very meaningful.
Yes.
This involves a lot of discipline.
Yes.
And becomes boring.
Yes.
And
boring.
People do it automatically.
Boring.
And don't think about what they're doing.
Yes.
And therefore causes them to leave off doing
it. But guess what? Boring gets a bad rap. how many people had cornflakes this morning for breakfast? Cheerios? Oat squares? Cereal of any kind? Okay, great. Coffee? Yeah.
Same.
Yeah. Did everyone brush their teeth this morning?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, kind of like went through the basic routines.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
Isn't that boring?
Yeah.
Of course it's boring, but guess what? Most of our lives are boring.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing to be boring necessarily. I guess what I'm saying is the advantage of this model is precisely the disadvantage of this one. The disadvantage of this model is the advantage of this one. Or, to put it differently, if you're looking for some sort of an ideal prayer, it probably will take aspects of both. And that's really the point.
But you don't keep your youth this way.
No, you don't. But you do keep your relationship with God this way. If you're there. In other words, like I like the word discipline that you say. This is about discipline. And let's, you know, forget about God for a second. Think about any meaningful relationship. This is sort of the choice. You could go this route. It's going to be passionate. It's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. And it's going to last exactly one night. Or you can go this route, right? Which is boring and like, oh my gosh. One more time with the same stuff. But guess what? There's going to be a quality and a discipline and a depth to the relationship that won't exist over here. Now you might say, well, it can't be one or the other. It really has to be both. And it does have to be both in an ideal world. But we don't always live in an ideal world. And sometimes we have to choose. And it's not always possible to have both simultaneously. Okay? So really what the rabbis are offering us is two fundamentally different models, but with the understanding that we have to bring them together in order to create what might be termed an ideal prayer. Okay, here's my question, just as I asked over here. If I wanted to turn this into a liturgy, it would be a piece of cake. What would that liturgy look like?
What same would it look words, like? Same words.
Same words every single day. Same words. A formula. Okay? Formulaic, for sure. What else? Phrase in the plural or the singular?
Plural.
Absolutely, yeah, phrase plural. In the plural. Right? What sort of thing? What would be the content of this prayer? Community, communal needs, and individual, I would say. But individual needs only as they pertain to all of us. What we all need. Oh, everybody needs wisdom, don't they? Everybody needs forgiveness, don't they? Everybody needs
health,
don't they? My father says a little parnassa wouldn't hurt. Everybody needs a livelihood, don't they? Yeah, of course. Those are the things that all of us need in common. That's what would be in that prayer. It wouldn't be the grand spiritual moment that only I can experience. That would be this prayer. This is something else. Something else entirely. What is that liturgy
that captures this model.
Okay.
This is called the Shmoneh Esrei. If you want to understand what the Shmoneh Esrei is about, this is what it's about. If you want to understand why it's so boring, this is why it's so boring, so to speak. If you want to understand why it's always the same words, this is why. Because it's an attempt to capture this essence of what prayer is. If this is what prayer is, and I turn that into a liturgy, it has to become a Shmoneh Esrei. Now you might say, Nebuch, oh, but the Shmoneh Esrei, I mean, whatever, how can I do this day in, day, whatever. That's what this model is about. If you're looking for this model, then don't look for the Shmoneh Esrei to help you. Because it won't. You're asking it to do something that it can't do. Sort of.
Yes, it can. That's right.
Yes, it can. But how?
I can stop in it and not have to finish when everybody else does.
Beautiful.
Find all of those.
Beautiful. Excellent. And the halacha actually says that's what we ought to do. In other words, the Shmoneh Esrei was never intended to be the final word in prayer. It was a scaffolding. It was a framework. Or the way the halacha puts it, let's say I happen to know somebody close to me that needs healing. I get to that blessing in the Shmoneh Esrei, what do?
Stop.
I stop and I think about them. I pray for them. I insert my own personal entreaty for them at that moment. And it's spontaneous. And it's individual. And it's no longer about everyone else, but it's about me and that person. And we're supposed to do that, by the way.
You freed me up from all these guys rushing through it. Thank you.
But not every. But you can't do that every time unless you're retired.
Well, that's the tension, isn't it? Right? These two models are in tension with each other. That really is the essential point. And sometimes we have to choose.
There are times when it's not. There are many times, and I'm sure we'd all agree, when you just not up to have a conversation with God. Just not. You just don't feel like you can do it.
Yes.
But I think the obligatory nature of tefillah is even more important than that.
Excellent.
Because you're supporting other people who need it.
And that's this side of the board. Okay? In other words, if you want to talk about communal structure, it's hard to sustain it with this. If you want to talk about something larger than yourself, it's hard to sustain it with this. You need this. But of course, there is a danger, right? The danger is all the disadvantages that we are so familiar with, associated with this kind of prayer. By the way, and this is not an accident, the first blessing of the Shmoneh Esrei, the rabbis call the blessing of Avot, the patriarchs. Why is that? Because the rabbis know exactly how dangerous the move is. We've created something that could turn into a monster. Don't forget that it has to have this quality. So even as we start the Shmoneh Esrei, we start it from the reference point of the patriarchal model. Is that like brilliant?
Yes.
Totally brilliant. Okay, now, let's take a step back and see how the Rambam understood this. Because now the Rambam is going to insert Ezra and the men of the Great Assembly into this discussion. I.e., at some point, we move from this model, patriarchal, let's just call it early, to this model, which is obviously later. Because the patriarchs exist well before the temple stands in Jerusalem. Right? So how do we sort of move from one to the other? And at what point? And what is the trigger? So let's have a look at the Rambam. We're going to skip a little bit. We're in source number 8. Okay, this is Rambam's introduction to the laws of prayer. People see that? Source number 8?
Page 6.
Okay. And we're just going to read it. Who would like to read the first paragraph? We'll take turns. Go ahead, please.
It is a positive Torah commandment to pray every day, as Exodus 23 states, "You shall serve God, your Lord." Tradition teaches us that this service is prayer, as Deuteronomy states, and serve him with all your heart. And our sages said, which is the service of the heart? This is prayer. Your prayers.
Go on, sorry.
Not prescribed in the Torah, nor does it prescribe a specific formula for prayer. Also, the Torah law, also according to Torah law, there are no fixed times for prayer.
Wow, listen to that. Okay, the original model of Torah prayer, right, which Rambam calls, the rabbis called, listen to this term, service of the heart. Okay, avodah shebalev, service of the heart. Right? Well, what exactly is the obligation of Torah prayer, says Rambam? Once a day. When?
Whenever
you want. Right? And what do you say exactly? Whatever you want. And how many times? As much as you want. There are no rules. Except that it be done once a day. Right? So what'll be that once a day? Whatever you feel is appropriate for the day that you're having. You're having a great day at ELS. Great. So say a blessing. Thank God I'm here in Jerusalem studying. Great. You just fulfilled the obligation of prayer, according to the Rambam.
Was this a tshuva to a question?
No, he just wrote it.
This was his things, you know.
Everything's a tshuva to a question, right?
No, like somebody was saying, I'm going on a trip,
This is Rambam.
This is general.
You should know this about Maimonides in general. Maimonides invents very little, right? He draws on rabbinic literature. That's the source for his rulings. Okay, now he puts the pieces together. That is his invention, so to speak. But the idea that prayer is service of the heart is a rabbinic idea. Okay, so Rambam presents us with this model, call it the original model of prayer, which, between you and me, sounds an awful lot like what we were referring to as avot.
But meantime, he's probably davening three times a day.
He is.
Yeah.
Okay, but we'll have to see what happens. So let's go on to the second paragraph. Who wants to read paragraph 2? Go ahead.
Therefore, women and slaves are obligated to pray, since it is not a time-oriented commandment. Rather, this commandment obligates each person to offer supplication and prayer every day and utter praises of the Holy One, blessed be He. Then petition for all his needs with requests and supplications. And finally, give praise and thanks to God for the goodness that he has bestowed upon him, each one according to his own ability.
Okay, so the first line of that halakha basically is a larger discussion in sort of the world of Talmudic thought. Women are not obligated, according to Talmudic law, concerning those positive commands which have a specific time, without getting into the whole discussion. Now, all I'm going to say is Rambam argues prayer is not one of those things, because the way he presents prayer, there is no specific time. And therefore, women are obligated like anybody else. The obligation of men and women in this Torah mitzvah of prayer is the same. Okay. The other thing that he brings out in this paragraph is, while it is the case that prayer sort of has few parameters, according to Torah law, there are still a couple of parameters, or three actually. A prayer has to include three components. Even the most basic prayer, the Torahidic prayer. What are those three components?
Thankful.
Good. Praise. Thanks. And request. Okay, praise, request, and thanks. Praise means, God, you're great. Request means, God, I really need your help because, I'm having an exam today. And thanks means, thanks, God, for, breakfast, whatever it was. If I wanted to combine this 1 second in one line, I might say something like, God, you're amazing. Let me have a good day, and thanks for all the grub. I'm done. That was my Torah prayer. I just fulfilled a Torah prayer according to the Rambam. Mahadrin.
According to your ability.
Yes.
And where does that come from?
The
Torah didn't say those.
It's such a good question that you just asked. The commentaries on the Rambam are not entirely sure where he got this idea from. Now, I'm going to suggest that we do have a couple of models in the patriarchal realm that seem to indicate this kind of content. And what I'm thinking of specifically is Jacob's prayer on the eve of his meeting with his brother. What does Jacob say? You know what, God? When I started out on this journey, I had almost nothing, and now I have so much. Thanks. God, I really need your help because Esav is planning to kill me. God, you are the God of my ancestors. As I would argue, Rambam got the idea from some of the patriarchal models of prayer that are preserved in the text. But you're right, strictly speaking, if I'm really going to take this to its logical conclusion, there are no rules. So this sort of becomes a difficult proposition. Now, the other thing I think that Rambam is doing, we're not quite there yet, is that he's reverse engineering. This is going to be the Shmoneh Esrei ultimately. And then Rambam's sort of going to take that back so that there's some sort of an affinity, a natural affinity, between the Shmoneh Esrei as we understand it, as we have it, and this earlier model that he calls Torah prayer. Yes?
So it wasn't his idea. I mean, he's just, because the liturgy was written, at least we're told by the Shnei Knesset Gedolim.
Correct.
And he lived in the 12th century.
Correct.
He's reciting the Shmoneh Esrei.
Yes, he is.
So he's just unpacking it.
Yes, that's true. But again, that's kind of novel to sort of imagine. He's going to take the essence of the Shmoneh Esrei and claim that really is the essence of prayer, even in this model. We didn't actually see that. Now we could again sort of imagine what Avraham might have said at the moment and sort of assume that it may have involved these elements, but it's not clear. The question stands.
I think somebody saw it, but the Rambam was better at marketing.
Maybe.
Now we can have a lot shorter service and market it really well.
Just stay home. Do it at home. All right, paragraph 3. Who wants to read paragraph 3, which sort of brings this idea together of the Torah prayer? Who wants to read that? Yes, go ahead.
A person who was eloquent would offer many prayers and requests. Conversely, a person who was inarticulate would speak as well as he could and whenever he desired. Similarly, the number of prayers was dependent on each person's ability. Some would pray once daily, others several times. Everyone would pray facing the holy temple, wherever he might be. This was the ongoing practice from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until Ezra.
Okay, great. Excellent. So basically what Rambam describes is this, basically. Now Rambam will say this is the practice from the time of Moshe. Why? Because if it's a Torah command, we don't learn Torah commands from the activity of the patriarchs. That's just a technical thing. Right? Torah commands begin with the giving of the Torah at Sinai. So Rambam is going to have to sort of find support in that material. But you know and I know that really what he's describing fundamentally is something that would have existed well before the Torah is given. Because that's the nature of the prayer that he's describing. It's what we were calling the patriarchal prayer. That's what it looks like. Any human being who has any sort of emotional life, right, and any sort of a spiritual life will be engaging in this kind of activity as they see fit. Which is precisely what this prayer looks like. Ah, this is the practice, says Rambam, from the time of Moshe until the time of Ezra. Now we're back to Ezra. So let's see what happens. Paragraph 4 is bolded, I hope. Is it bolded in your copy?
Yes.
Okay, good. I made it bolded. The Rambam didn't bold it. I bolded it. Okay? Because this is the pivot point of our discussion. Who wants to read paragraph 4? Renee? Yeah? Did you read already?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead, Ronnie. No. I thought you didn't want to.
I like the language of the English.
When Israel was exiled in the time of the wicked Nebuchadnezzar, they became interspersed in Persia and Greece and other nations.
children were born to them in these foreign countries, and these, and those children's language was confused. The speech of each and every one was a concoction of many tongues. No one was able to express himself coherently in any one language, but rather in a mixture of languages. As Nehemia states, and their children spoke half in Ashdodit and did not know how to speak the Jewish language, but they would speak according to the language of various other peoples. It's like when you speak Hebrew with English together.
That's right. Okay, one more paragraph.
Ronnie,
go ahead. Paragraph 6. Sorry, 5.
Consequently, when someone would pray, he would be limited in his ability to request his needs or to praise the Holy One, blessed be he, in Hebrew, unless other languages were mixed in with it. When Ezra and his court saw this, they established 18 blessings in secret.
That's called the Shmoneh Esrei. Okay, so what is Rambam claiming now? This is absolutely startling. Rambam says the Shmoneh Esrei should never have been created. What do I mean by that?
It was only because of circumstance.
It was a reaction, exactly. It was a response. It was a response and a reaction to difficult circumstances. What were those difficult circumstances or their cause?
Exile.
Okay?
Language.
Exile means many things, but culturally and ritually and linguistically it means it's much more difficult to communicate. And here I am, Nebuch, I want to pray to God, and I want to speak the Mamaloshan, so to speak, right? The original language of my ancestors, and I don't even know where to begin. I can't engage in this activity with the kind of words that I would like to employ. So Ezra says, you know what? We'll create some sort of a framework to allow that to happen. So that every Jew, no matter what their level of education, no matter what their eloquence or their ability to express themselves, will be able to find the words. And that's what the Shmoneh Esrei was about. So the Rambam basically understands what we have been describing as two different models of prayer actually is a story of some sort of a historical development. We started out with one, and it served us well for as long as it did, but the moment came when it could no longer address our needs, and we had to create something different. And that's what the Shmoneh Esrei was about. Or, if I were to now generalize, I might say, that's what Rabbinic Judaism was about too. We had a particular model, and it worked for as long as it did. But then something cataclysmic happened, and the temple was destroyed, and the people of Israel were exiled. And the burning question became, how are we going to go on from here? First temple, second temple, it's the same kind of process. And the answer is, we're going to have to do something to hold us together. Because if we don't do something to hold us together, and this guy lives in Rome, and that guy lives in wherever he lives, a million other different places under the sun, then how will we ever come together? How will we ever stay together or preserve an identity? And the answer is, we will create a liturgy. I'm almost tempted to say, to take the place of that national framework that existed earlier. Now, I know you're going to say, well, wait a second, though. Ezra's in Jerusalem. He is. But most of the Jews are not. Okay? Most of the Jews remain in exile. How will we maintain our connection with each other? In the absence of some sort of a national framework that holds us together organically. And the answer is we have to create things that will take the place of that framework. That's what Shmoneh Esrei is. Okay, so now, any Jew, anywhere, anytime, can find the words. Now you might say, yeah, but whatever, I wanted my own words. Great, that was how it used to be. And there's value in it. And don't give up on that. But that's not what Shmoneh Esrei was about. Shmoneh Esrei was about reminding us of our identity as a people. Holding us together as a people. And I think that's where we sort of trip up a little bit. There's a reason why the Shmoneh Esrei has the content that it does. Because it's not just about me. It's about the people of Israel. And what the people of Israel need. Right, so Rambam will say, we got 3 minutes. I'm just going to do it very, very quickly. If we were to break down the Shmoneh Esrei, we would discover the following. Okay, we would discover the following. The Shmoneh Esrei is composed of 18 blessings, but it's really 19 these days, because it underwent another development later on. So I'm going to call it 18 plus 1. There are the first three blessings, there are the last three blessings. They never change. That's the Korban HaTamid in disguise, the daily sacrifice. Whatever day of the year it is, whatever prayer it is, it could be Ne'ila on Yom Kippur, the first three blessings and the last three blessings will be the same. Okay? First three are praise. The last three are gratitude. That was the Rambam again. And the intermediate, I'm going to call it 12 plus 1, are
petition.
Or request. Or statement of needs. Okay? Now, here's how it works. The middle section is actually subdivided. I can't go through it all now. You're going to have to trust me. Next time you look through the Siddur, have this in mind. Okay? Subdivided into 6 and 6. Plus 1. There's always the plus 1 in there. Okay? 6 of those middle blessings speak to the needs of the individual. What we all need as individuals. Like I said, wisdom, understanding, forgiveness, you know, redemption in our personal lives, health, parnasa, that sort of stuff. Okay? And 6 of those pertain to communal and national needs. Ingathering of the exiles, justice for all, neutralizing our enemies, supporting the righteous, Jerusalem, the Davidic line. Those are not individual needs. Those are communal. They're national needs. And part of the Shmoneh Esrei, by the way, is to remind us of what our needs are. Because sometimes we forget what we need. Okay? But that's the breakdown. Now, the truth is, I could break it down further. And I could say, guess what? There's three, which there are. Okay, how does that work? These are spiritual. These are physical. I need wisdom, I need understanding, I need forgiveness. That's spiritual. Right? I need health, I need sustenance. That's physical. And over here, it's the opposite. These are physical. In gathering of exiles, courts and just rulers, neutralizing our enemies, and they're spiritual, right? Support for the righteous, rebuilding of Jerusalem, the Davidic line. Okay, all of this converges, you might say, with this other blessing, which I keep putting to the side, even though it's not the one that's added, by the way. But once that blessing is added, that is added to the scheme, this is what will emerge. This one is called the catch-all blessing. Shomea tefillah, God who hears our prayer. It's general. It's open-ended. It contains all of this material and everything that's not this material. Let's just call it the blessing of God who hears our prayer.
It's amazing how often the dead are mentioned.
Yes, they come up in this section. The ultimate praise, the ultimate statement of God's transcendence, is that God can resurrect the dead. Or to put it differently, why would I waste my time praying to God unless I thought that God could actually do something? Right? That's sort of, I'm being cynical a little bit, but that's kind of what's happening in these first three blessings. Praise means I'm acknowledging God as transcendent and absolute. That's what praise means. Oh, well, once I've done that, prayer makes sense. If God is neither transcendent nor absolute, then what am I wasting my time for? He can't help me anyways. Right? It's just wishful thinking. I have to sort of come from a premise of God who actually could do something. Maybe he won't. I don't know. But if he can't, then I'm wasting my time. So praise is about recognizing that God is capable. Right? Petition is about stating what it is that we need. You know, some people say buttering him up. I don't really go for that. I think it's a little more nuanced than that. Right? It's really about recognizing God's transcendence, which makes this part meaningful or possible. Right? And like your parents always taught you and you taught your kids, what? You shouldn't say thank you? Of course you say thank you. What kind of a person doesn't say thank you when you know, they get some sort of a benefit? They say thank you to their benefactor. That's what the last section is about. Okay, we have to stop here, so we will. There's more to discuss. What I wanted to demonstrate this morning was that Ezra, as some sort of a representative, quote-unquote, for the earliest form of rabbinic Judaism, is dealing with challenges which require some sort of a different response. And essentially, that different response will be inspired by what has preceded, even as it begins to look in a different direction to deal with challenges that the earlier generations could never have imagined. And that's essentially what the enterprise of rabbinic Judaism set out to do, which is how we ended up the way we did. Okay? Yes, some of it was reactive, and some of it was, as it were, after the fact, and maybe not ideal, but nevertheless, I feel like at the end of the day, the intentions were absolutely pure, and the outcome wasn't so terrible either, at the end of the day. With all respect to the Karaites.
Yeah. We only pray twice.
Okay. Twice a day?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.